Podcasting worldwide from Vancouver, Canada. Welcome back to the Personal Process Podcast. The show that takes you through the growth, hardship, self-discovery, lessons, and stories of individuals who achieved success in their own personal path. Trust the process.
Welcome back to another episode of the Personal Process Podcast. Today's episode, we got Dr. Carl Raven. He told us to call him just by Carl because he's very humble. And, you know, we're very excited to have an amazing individual on our show. And we're going to talk about a lot of things that, in my opinion, are super important. Soft skills. We're going to talk about MBTI. And we're going to be talking about diversity and how to make the world a better place. So with that said, Carl, is there anything that I missed or anything that you'd like to include in addition to that?
No, great to be with you today, Carl.
Awesome. So thank you very much for being here, Carl. I'm just wondering, you know, these statements that you're mentioning, the communication skills and all that, it's something that a lot of people don't talk about. So do you mind kind of taking us back in time? What led to this? You know, tell us a little bit about your past and how this kind of went about.
Well, you know, I just over my career, I've I know some people would call it a blessing. Some people would say, wow, you know, you job hopped a lot. But I've been in a few different careers. You know, I started in retail. And my very first job was pulling shopping carts at if you have a Costco up in Vancouver, before Costco was Price Club. And so in high school, I was pulling shopping carts out in Price Club. Right. So if you see those folks out there in all the weather, pulling those shopping carts, making sure everyone has them, just remember, you know, I have the most respect for them. And every time I see them, I try to be as nice as possible to them, you know. But doing that, working my way through college, working in retail, selling appliances at Sears, which is almost no longer existent, right?
Yeah.
I've worked at a group home. I've worked in human services. I've worked for the federal government. I worked at an Air Force base, running youth programs for the United States Air Force at Edwards Air Force Base. I've worked as a case manager for like Kern County Department of Human Services here in California. So, and their welfare to work side. And then for the last 15 years, I've been a trainer traveling up and down the state, training other human service professionals for UC Davis, which is one of the University of California schools here, and also Sacramento State University here for the last 5 years, training state employees. And the one thing that just stands out more than anything else is the ability to make sure that we communicate and we communicate clearly with each other. And there's so many roadblocks to being able to effectively communicate. And a lot of times it just has to do with ourselves and what we expect and what we think is important. And the important thing to remember is just because we think something's important or it's part of our history, part of our makeup and our experience, the other person sitting right across from me may not share that experience, may not have a clue how I've lived or what I've been through. And I may have the same issue. I always say in every class, yesterday I said it twice in two classes, we're a fingerprint. Every one of us, we're a fingerprint. Even if we have the same Myers-Briggs type or we have the same DISC letter or, you know, the same temperament, that doesn't make, you know, someone a cookie cutter of somebody else. We shouldn't always expect everyone to react to everything in different ways because we all, you know, unless we grew up in the same city, in the same neighborhood, on the same street, and even in the same house, right? We may not have a different view. We may not have the same view of the world. And
absolutely.
Even brothers and sisters and cousins can tell you, you know, there's always that one black sheep in the family, that one that stands out. But, you know, we all were raised together, but, you know,
that one was different.
Were you sleeping outside or something? Right? You know, so, you have such a diversity of people and everybody has their own special difference, you know, and that's so I really try to work with that and everything that I talk about. And I've been spending a lot of time these last 9 months doing classes and seminars on mindfulness, right? And having a growth mindset and and also working on implicit bias, right? And being an anti-racist practice. And then also, you know, mixing that in with, you know, communication skills and how what we bring to the table is so important. And it's so important for us to express to other people.
It definitely is, Carlin. You know, I should have asked you, what haven't you done in life? Because you just went through a whole spectrum of everything. I love it. And, you know, Carl, this is a very exciting talk for me because I think we're going to be talking about a lot of skills that I value personally a lot. But I feel, I'm not sure if you can concur, but a lot of people don't understand the value of, you know, the soft skills of understanding the biases people have. And, you know, as you mentioned, like, even if you're in the same environment, there can be so many differences that happen between individuals. So my question to you, before we even get down to the details of how to do this in our life, is when did you personally become aware of these soft skills and the importance of it? Is there a time you can tell us an experience?
You know, I've always been, I think it's just my personality. You know, Myers-Briggs, I'm an ISFP, right? One of the things that I didn't know this until I took my very first Myers-Briggs test when I was 40 years old, right? But
wow.
there's always been some inherent feeling of trying to make sure that the impact that I was trying to provide somebody else was met by them, that they received it, right? So, I mean, even as a kid, I hate to call myself a people pleaser, but, you know, until I realized, you know, that I had to stand up for myself, I very much was a people pleaser. And I was always looking for how people responded to me and what they were looking for from me and what were the right things to do to make other people smile or feel positive being around me. I've always, you know, felt good in interviews, you know, job interviews and things like that. Of course, there's been interviews I haven't gotten, but I've always just tried to make sure that I'm paying attention to that person that I'm with and making sure that I'm picking up cues and seeing what they're responding to, what they're not. I don't know. I think it's my personality. It wasn't a book I read when I was a kid or anything. I didn't read How to Win Friends and Influence People until I was much older. Right?
Great book.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. So it's just something that I've always tried to be attuned to how other people are feeling. I guess, you know, probably 11 or 12.
11 or 12?
I was 11 or 12. It was the first time I ever got my butt kicked.
Your butt kicked?
My butt kicked.
Oh, man.
And I think that was an awakening. You know, because I was always bigger than kids growing up. I was always taller and I was just bigger. I mean, I was a big kid. And so most of my friends weren't as big as me. And so I didn't know exactly what to do with it. So I would just bulge my way through things, you know, hey, barge my way through. Let's do this. Follow me. Let's go. Come on, guys. Yeah. Listen to me. And I never had anybody challenge me
right
on that. Until I think I was 11. And yeah. I had one of my friends say, no, you know, we don't have to do what you want to do just because you want to do it. And he stood right in front of me. And it really made me think, okay, well, wow. Okay. Well, there's something wrong with that guy. No. But then I had a friend at school who, you know, we used to roughhouse and I tried to physically get him to do what I wanted. And he put me up against the wall and he said, I'm not going to do what you asked me to do. And it's one of those, I don't know if you have those things that you remember as a kid, those seminal moments. Sure. It's one of those moments where I realized I'm not going to just be able to barge my way and bully my way through life. You know, there's got to be a better way to win friends and influence people, right? So, you know, how do I use myself in the best way and really try to get people to want to follow me rather than dragging them along? So I, you know, if you said that's really a place where my idea of the world changed, my idea of who I am and what I wanted to be and who I was to other people changed.
And that's really huge, you know, and it's a very young age. Keep in mind, 12 is, what is that? The fifth grade, sixth grade, something around there.
Seventh grade. Yeah.
Seventh grade, you know, And I don't know about you, Carl, but I can even say till today, I'm mid 20s and I still have so much to learn. I'm amazed at how much progress I've made since those years. And, you know, to have that experience come up, it's really, first of all, it's interesting that you got that experience from it, because a lot of people would have just maybe took it to another level and be like, oh, you're not listening to me. Let me try harder. But, you know, you took a moment to reflect. And I think that reflection just gave you a lot of insight and it went to the communication skills. So, you know, we're talking about how to analyze situations and get the other person to understand us and to maybe not use influence in a very negative way that it has some connotations to, but to see us from the best light and for us to show us the value and understand them in the ways that they want to be understood. So with that said, Carl, can you give us some insight on that level? What are some things that people can take away from conversations, from, you know, interviews, networking that will better their life? What are like your top three tips? And this is on the spot, so no pressure at all.
Mm-hmm. Well, first is to recognize we're all fingerprints, right? So we all are unique. Even if we think something's worked with somebody, not the first 99 people, that 100th person may not respond. And it's something I had to learn early in my career as a seminar facilitator, trainer. There are some groups that are talkative and they're laughing and they're having a great time face-to-face or virtually, right? And then there's some groups who are just stone-facing you and they're just sitting there. And it's something I had to realize. When it first happened, I said, oh my God, am I doing this right? Am I being who I want to be? Am I getting my message across? And then I got the responses back and evaluation. This was a great class and I learned so much. And what I realized is very often those classes that are very quiet, they might be packed with introverts, but also if they're paying attention, very often people will be quiet and not want to interject all the time. And sometimes the noisiest groups and the ones that are more interactive are where I'm going to get more feedback. Like, yeah, I wish you would have said this, or I wish you would have said that a little more. Mm. Right. So it was a bit of a
learning conundrum
for me. Yeah. And it was the opposite of what the expectation was. So I had to realize that, you know, you're not always going to reach everyone in the same exact way. Right. So everyone's a fingerprint. The second thing that, a lot of us were taught things at a young age. And, you know, if you believe, you know, Freudian psychology, everything you learn from the time you're born to your 11 or 12 makes up who you are, right?
Oh, yeah.
Jung says most of your personality is genetic, but that early in childhood interactions with people that you love or care about or respect, and, you know, whether it's a parent or a teacher or a grandparent or a pastor or a coach, somebody else like that, those lessons that we learn and the life experiences we have at that age are what we bring out into the world. And so the important thing that a lot of people learn are the ideas of respect, right? And the ideas of the golden rule, right? Treat people the way you want to be treated. Do unto others, you know, biblical thing. So the second thing that I always say is, you know, the golden rule is great. And it's a great tool to teach young people how to respect, be respectful and be polite and be kind. But when you're an adult, it doesn't always work. The platinum rule is what really works. And maybe people have seen the platinum rule. Have you ever heard of the platinum rule?
I have not.
Yeah. Okay. Well, you know, there's been some commercials and stuff, so I feel like it's been watered down. but the platinum rule, where the golden rule is treat people the way you want to be treated. The platinum rule is to treat people the way they want to be treated.
Bam.
And so how do we do that? And it's really important to be intentional. Some of us don't have to be intentional. When we're in a conversation, we're looking to get, you know, other people's responses.
Right.
We're really trying to hear them and try to get as deep as possible. I mean, you know, with the podcast, I'm sure, you know, and I've listened to a few of your podcasts, and you let the guests do most of the speaking, which, so you're right on tack. You'd be a great coach, right? That 85-15 rule.
I appreciate that, Carl.
Yeah, no problem. But being a good listener and paying attention, being present in the moment when you're having that conversation with somebody is not only the best way to learn insights about that person, but it's the best way to build that relationship. And the better relationship you have with somebody else, the more information they're going to share with you. Now, there's sometimes we don't want all the information, right? But there's some jobs and some times in life where, you know, we need to be there for people that we care about and our loved ones. And sometimes the problem is underneath the surface, or it hasn't been expressed. And sometimes people just need someone to be able to vent to. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, the third thing is just to be a good listener, you know, to really be that person that listens to hear, listens to comprehend rather than listening to respond.
That's right? Huge. You know,
yeah, because we do so much of the listening to respond these days. If you see every conversation, I call it verbal ping pong. I say something, you say something, I say something, you say something. And then while you're talking, I'm thinking about what I'm going to say next. And so I'm just taking a part of what you're going to say, and then I'm going to go off on my own. And then, okay, well, you're doing that. Well, I'm going to go off on my own too. And the next thing you know,
what are we even talking about?
What are we even talking about? What did we learn? Did we get anything out of this? And are we going to go to that person again to have that type of conversation?
Yeah.
Right. So having that person that truly hears you, I think it's so valuable. I think there's many more people who listen to respond rather than listen to comprehend. If you can listen to comprehend, you can be that person that you want to be for other people. That being said, it's not always easy, right? Half of us, you know, if you believe Jung and Myers-Briggs and everything, about half of us are people-focused, where we're thinking about other folks and trying to use empathy and compassion, mm-hmm. right? And the other half of us are process-focused, where we're focused on completing the tasks.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Right? And so, yeah.
So Carl, just sorry, you add a lot of value here. I just wanted to kind of break some things down. So first of all, with regards to the platinum rule, I've never heard of it, but it's so true. And kind of just going back to How to Win Friends and Influence People by Dale Carnegie. Yeah. It's funny because, you know, I actually use that one principle of listening to people, and I used it deliberately on one of these individuals who was my acquaintance. I didn't really know him well, but Carl, I swear to God, you know, it's, I just listened to him and I'm just like, yeah. And I was genuinely interested. It was such a cool story that he was telling us. At the end of it, I didn't even say a word. Do you know what he replied? Man, that was the best conversation that I had in my life. And this isn't someone that I'm super close with. This was someone that I kind of, you know, met in the library, talked for a little bit, friends of friends. And he said that. And ever since, like, we've been such good friends, connected on such a deep, intimate level, and just talked about life. And that was one of the things that, I think the book was mentioned. It's saying that if you want to be a good I can't even say it right now. If you want to be good at conversing,
conversationalist, yes.
There you go. Love it. Thank you, Carl. You know, just listen, because you can't just talk. If you talk, people don't want to listen to you. And they realistically, I think people just want to talk about themselves, which is what you were mentioning, Carl, which had a lot of value. Now, before we go into discussing what Carl Jung has done for psychology and your, you know, take on it, in addition to what the MBTI is, because I think, you know, a lot of people do know about it, but there is also a huge segment that don't even know what it is. I just want to talk to you, Carl, about one thing in specific that you mentioned for, I believe it was rule two. You mentioned that, you know, people learn things up until the age of 12, and that kind of carries them forward without, you know, if they don't reflect on it and adequately take action. Now, a lot of individuals have had an amazing childhood that have gone forward, and, you know, they've taken a lot of good lessons, such as the golden rule, and maybe even, if they're lucky, the platinum rule. But there are others who have not had the best childhood and had maybe a harsher upbringing. How can they go forward and correct these mistakes if they want to, you know, get the most out of their life and attain fulfillment, as I hope most people like to in this podcast?
Well, yeah. So I really think it's important to do a lot of examination of yourself. And, you know, it's not always easy to do. I mean, I can just a throwaway line. I always tell people I didn't know what I wanted to be growing up until I was 29 years old.
29.
And what happened when I was 29 is I made peace with my father.
Hmm.
And it wasn't anything overtly he did. He wasn't around. My parents split up when I was 3. And we lived in the San Francisco Bay Area. I grew up in San Francisco and just down the peninsula in San Bruno, which is across the freeway from the San Francisco airport. And so he was in the area until I was 9. And then he moved to Los Angeles, which is, you know, 6.5-hour drive away for his work. And
right,
it was something that maybe, you know, where I would see him every weekend or every, you know, couple weekends a month to, you know, a couple times a year.
Wow.
And it was not only that, my father was really, you know, gracious when he talked about my mom and my family and things like that. But the challenge was it wasn't reciprocated. And so, you know, I wouldn't get a whole lot of positive reinforcement and positive thoughts about my father from my, I was raised by 3 women, my mom and both my grandmothers. And
right,
they weren't very happy with the fact that he left his only son, his only child, you know,
right,
and went down for work. Although, you know, the older I get, the more I realize what, you know, he had to do what he had to do, but
yeah,
it there was some resentment and I had a feeling like he owed me things and,
right,
you know, and, I felt entitled, you know, and I mean, it was my mom, she did the best she could. She was a single mom. She was a great single mom. She made good money, you know, and, or decent money. And, you know, I had a pretty good childhood. I mean, I got to do some things, I sang in the San Francisco Boys Chorus and traveled the world and sang for the Queen of England and did a bunch of cool things like that. And then
that's not too shabby.
No, I could, like I'm saying, who am I to complain about my childhood, right?
But yeah,
And then I played baseball and I did well, and and I played a little bit in college and things like that. So I mean, I had those things going for me. I had some esteem, and that was an important thing: is esteem, right? Mm. Having a high regard for yourself. And as a kid, sometimes you have to manufacture that, right?
Right.
So it's a so I understand that feeling of resentment or hurt. And I even went and lived with my father when I was 20. I lived with him for 3 years. And we solidified our relationship, and it was a lot better. We were some bumpy things. I mean, when I first moved down there, I got kicked out maybe 3 or 4 times in the first
wow.
6 months. Yeah, well, because my mom kind of let me get away with some things that my dad said, no, this is not what's going to happen in my house. Well, unfortunately, I was 21 years old. But when he's trying to lay down the law,
it's a little bit too late.
Right. So,
yeah.
But we came to an understanding, and it took a few years, but I mean, we were, we were really tight. Now he's my best friend. But I remember, when I was 29, we were sitting around his birthday, and we're sitting around and just watching TV and drinking cognac. And he,
nice.
Yeah. And he, and I brought up something about my childhood, and he said, he goes, I don't know how to say this to you, but I love you and you're my best friend. But if you want me to keep apologizing to you for your childhood, I don't know how much longer I can do that and how many more times I can do that. And I don't know if we're going to be able to have the type of relationship that we both want with each other.
Wow.
And I was upset, because I was still a little entitled, right? It's kind of like when that kid pushed me up and jacked me up and said, no, I'm not going to do what you said. All of a sudden I had that pushback, and it's like, whoa, that's not what I was looking for, right? And then I had to think about, what was it what I was looking for? What really was I looking for from that conversation? And was it just going over ground we've already covered? And so I went back to work on that Monday, and I worked, I went at the Air Force Base, and one of my friends, she ran the Family Advocacy Center there, and she's also a licensed clinical social worker. So she sat down and we talked about it, and she said, well, do you think your dad had a point? And I said, when I talked to him, I didn't. But on the drive home and that Sunday, I realized he might have a point. How much longer am I going to hold this over his head? Right. And, he's apologized. He tried to make amends. He's tried to be, he's a great grandfather and all this other, my dad is not without his flaws. I mean, there's things that we all have in our lives that I'm sure we don't. It was something where I had to realize, if I was in his shoes and I tried to make amends for the millionth time and it kept getting thrown back in my face, how would I feel about interacting with that person? Right. And, that can be a real challenge.
It really can, Carl. Are you familiar with classical conditioning?
I've heard the term. Yeah.
Yeah. So essentially, classical conditioning, the main example that they give is Pavlov and his dog, where they ring the bell and then like the food. The bell gets paired with the food. Now, the theory that I have is when and why I think your father may have said that. First of all, that's such an amazing thing to say. He's just like, to be honest, I love you, but I honestly can't do this. It's a very mature insight to have. And I think that's awesome. First of all, I have a lot of respect for that. And I also have a lot of respect for you for, actually going back and, detaching from the self-esteem and the ego and just being like, no, he does have a point and he's here for me now. Now, just to come back quickly to this classical conditioning thing, when a lot of people are negative or they always take and don't reciprocate, I honestly believe that the negative emotions get paired with that person. So then next time when that person comes to us, we'll feel that negativity. And even if we don't want to, and we know that they want to do something bad, it's just like etched in, and what's that? There's this other thing. I can't think of the exact formula, but in psychology, essentially the first thing and then the last thing are like the most important.
Oh, recency and
recency primacy effect.
Primacy. Yeah.
Beautiful. Yeah. So, I think that's kind of what led to the hard part about you giving it up, because in the first part of your life that's what you felt, and even in the latter part he's trying to make up for it, but that's still there. And there are huge salient events are going to have more weight, but those primacy and recency, the later and the first events that happen, are what you're going to remember. And I think both of you guys just, you know, sat down and like had a deep, intimate conversation that changed. So like, let me ask you more on a personal note, because I've heard from friends and I've heard from so many individuals that, you know, like, you know, I'm going to quote, I hate my parents. I can't live with them. I'm so resentful. They ruined my life. And, you know, sure, I do not disagree that there are very terrible parents out there, but I'm going to go out and assume that there are some that, you know, it's just, like you mentioned, a communication, and wow, that's a great segue to go into the next topic, a communication issue. So I guess, what can you advise people that have gone through similar experiences like you, Carl, that they can go out and forge that great connection back after a rough start?
Ask yourself what you need. What is it that you need from this person to be able to move forward? And it's something that, you know, I've found, you know, I've been, I mean, we could go down different rabbit holes, but I've been a single dad since my daughter was 5 years old. She's now 19. And so I had full physical custody of my daughter, you know, for the last 14 years. And accountability is so important when you're having that conversation. Okay, so what is it that I'm responsible for? What am I not responsible for? But also, what is it that, you know, I can really look at myself and say, okay, well, I made that mistake, or this is something that I want to correct and I want to make sure it doesn't happen again. And when you're angry, when you're in the grip, when you're holding all that resentment and harboring all, I mean, it really stifles your creativity and your ability to think about yourself in a larger scale. What is my place in the world? Where am I going to go? You're stuck in that hole where this is who I am. This is who's keeping me here. And I'm not going to be able to move until I don't know what, you know? And so I really had to think about it was a great thing that my friend talked to me about. What is it that you want from you and your father's relationship? I said, well, I want us to have a good relationship and a working relationship. I want us to, you know, to be best friends, and I want to, you know, stop resenting him. He goes, well, she goes, well, why are you resenting him? I said, for what, you know, him leaving you as a child. I said, okay, well, have we already made amends on that? And I said, well, he said he's tried. She goes, did you hear him? And I honestly don't remember those things, those times that maybe he's tried to make amends. And I had to really think about it. And he told me, yeah, I did. And I had to think about it. I'm not listening. There's a fact that is in a lot of my communication classes that I live by. And it says that it's hardest to listen to those that we're closest to. We have the hardest time using communication and listening skills with those people that we're closest to. And I have a theory, and I believe that is because when we are engaged with those people that we care about, we use emotional thinking a lot more, right? Our limbic system is activated, right? And so because we have a lot of that emotional thinking going on, it's very hard to activate the rational part of our brain. And when we are in our emotional selves, you know, we can be super happy, we can be super sad, we can be super angry, or all those emotions, they come to the fore rather than what is actually happening, or what is that person saying, and what does that mean? That usually happens on the drive home for me, or the next day for me, right? So,
you think that, maybe that was a little bit harsh. Yeah. And Carl, you know, like, I know you're going to give us a lot more value, but there's already so much that we have to dissect here. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you're mentioning that you need to take responsibility. And I think, first of all, that's something that I want to kind of go down deeper a little bit, because I feel that for nowadays, a lot of people have that entitled perspective. And, you know, not everyone. There's a lot of individuals who don't. But I'm not sure if it's because of social media. I'm not sure if it's because of, I don't know, a new generation and participation medals, like the regular saying is saying. But how does one, you know, break off from that, I deserve everything, and go into a realm of, okay, you know what, I have a responsibility to act as a good son. I have a responsibility to, you know, you're teaching individuals now, so you have a responsibility to make an amazing class for people. How do you break apart from the thing that you just deserve something? Because that's something that I'm very passionate about helping others, because I believe that when you have and take responsibility, not only will you enjoy your life more, but you'll make the world a more understanding and better place. And I think inspire. And I think that's one of the messages that we wanted to talk about today. So Carl, please.
Yeah. So, I mean, just having that idea of, you know, I can make a difference. And, you know, my main value, and anybody asks me, what's your main value? What's your purpose in life? And it's to make a difference. That's what I want to do. But to be able to make a difference, I have to be able to be accountable to myself, to recognize the actions that I take, the words that I say, they have repercussions, right? Whether it's a positive repercussion or a negative repercussion. So to constantly be aware of that. And like I said, maybe it's just my personality where that FI dominant, you know, thing in Myers-Briggs is, you know, I'm thinking about that other person first, and, you know, and things that I'm saying are that way. But even folks who, you know, who aren't people, they're more process focused. You can intentionally do it, right? And you can plan to have those conversations where, you know, I want to listen. I want to hear what this person said. I also know that there's sometimes that this person I'm interacting with may come with excuses. They may come with anger. They may come with frustration. They may be aggressive in their communication styles. And that might challenge me, especially your fight or flight mechanism, right?
Absolutely.
My fight mechanism, I grew up, you know, in San Francisco, rode the buses by myself since I was 8 years old. So my fight mechanism is at 11, right? I'm always ready to, I'm at a hair trigger. I have this big keychain. My wife's like, why do you have such a big keychain? I thought when I was a kid, I had a big keychain, so I had something to swing.
Yeah.
You know, so, and not that I had to swing them a lot, but you always were
prepared. You gotta always
were alert. Yeah, sure. So, you know, just think about that conditioning as a kid and how it plays out now. And so recognizing that that is something, my first response, a lot of people, your first response is the right response. My first response is emotional.
Mm.
And if I allow that first response to be the right response for me, then that may not be the appropriate response for the situation, right? So when I'm, you know, and you see it in the political spectrum and in people wearing masks and all the other things that are happening.
Yeah.
When you see somebody who's doing something that you just think is reprehensible and sometimes morally wrong, not just, you know, but I mean, thinking about other folks, you know, it's something where I have to really take a deep breath and think about, okay, so what is the situation? So really having that perspective, recognizing, you know, the responsibility is in the way that you can regulate your response. So recognize when you're in your emotional center and how to get back to the rational center.
Absolutely. And Carl, let's dive in a little bit deeper, because we kind of talked about the emotional center, kind of a little bit focus on the fight, but there's a lot of individuals who kind of, you know, focus on the flight. And when I say that, let's talk about in a business setting where you had a lot of experience coaching and all that kind of stuff. You know, I haven't had the same experience as coaching businesses, but, you know, I've done some speaking events where I'm trying to help individuals who are in senior homes and community centers and things of that nature. Yeah. And I noticed that a lot of people kind of say, we'll just throw it to the side. It's not that important exercise. Whatever. And I'm sure in a business setting, you know, same thing, you know, like, yeah, you know, that person, he doesn't really do something like that, or, you know, that task is not too important, we'll throw it to the side. How can we counter this mindset? And should we counter this mindset, Carl? The mindset of, you know, just pushing things through the sides because they're so stressful. Like, for example, oh, this client's, you know, causing a lot of our clients to leave because he wants super priority and all this. Just, I can't think of many more examples like this, but do you understand what I'm trying to go for?
Yeah. Just brushing things aside because they're not that important.
Yeah. Right?
And like, I mean, I hate to be a broken record, but I have things that are important to me, and I have things that are deal breakers and are things that are non-negotiable for me, but I also have some flexibility and I understand where that is. And there's a lot of folks but I also have things that I procrastinate on that I push away, and there's things that cause me mental or physical anguish, right? You know, Tony Robbins says procrastination is the delay of pain, right? So
you know, that's a quote.
Yeah. So rather than dealing with this, let's just push it aside. If it's not going to be a big money drain, or if it's not going to affect our bottom line, and we'll just deal with it later. And I understand that there's some things that I don't want to necessarily deal with. There's some corners I'd like to be able to cut, but because I've been doing this you know, and working with people in soft skills. Most of my classes are soft skill related. It's really helped me to realize that just because I think something's important or not important doesn't mean that that other person feels the same way. Right.
And that's beautiful.
And I have topics like active listening and SMART goals that we talk about. And it always, always amazes me how many people have not heard of active listening or SMART goals. And I've been teaching them for 20 years and I've been talking with all these different people. And you know, there's thousands of people that have been in classes with me and presentations and keynotes and everything. But there's most of the classes that I'm in, you get a few people that have raised their hand that said they've been in an active listening training or have understood SMART goals. So I can't give it a short shrift because it's important in part of the entire theory of listening and goal setting, right? And so just because it's something I've done a million times, it goes back to Joe DiMaggio. You know who Joe DiMaggio, the famous baseball player. So Joe DiMaggio was a famous baseball player, grew up in San Francisco, and he's one of the most famous Yankees of all time, Hall of Famer. And he was getting towards the end of his career, and his knees were torn up in his shoulder, and so he had ice everywhere and just looked like he'd been through 15 rounds every game, right? And one of the press announcers asked him, said, "Well, Joe, how do you do it? You know, I mean, how do you do it how do you give your 100% every time?" And he said, "Because there might be a kid out there who's never seen me play before." And that's something I think about a lot. There's somebody out there who has not heard those things that I say, you know, 100 times a year in these different classes that I teach or keynotes. So I'm not going to downplay it. I'm not going to dismiss it. If there's something that has some type of impact or effect on the people that I'm working with or the organization, we need to look at it. Even if we look at it and decide a minute later that it really doesn't have any effect, right? But we need to take a look at it. You never knew who you're going to affect in a negative way or a positive way by introducing something that you think is just not that important or something that you think everyone should know.
Absolutely. Right?
Common sense is not common.
It's only common to you. I love it, Carl. And, you know, I think that same quote was similarly produced by, I don't know if it was Kobe or Michael, but he was mentioning that, you know, I show up to every single game and give it 100% because they're paying fans and they're out there to look for me. And I don't think it's only just for, you know, telling something that they don't know. I think even by leading by example, Carl, you know, if you bring up active listening and you're actually doing it, you can inspire people. You know, I had one English professor in university where, honestly, like, he just listened, he took notes, and like, I've never felt so important in my life. And, you know, that moment will always remain in my head, you know, and the impact you can make on an individual by being your authentic self and expressing these things. And, you know, you should do it every single day because you don't know what that in person that you're talking to is going through right now. And you don't know if you change their life, how they're going to change others. And that's the thing that I keep trying to stress for this podcast, Carl. You know, like, every single action isn't just one action. It's a network effect. You know, it's positivity.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. 100%. And I can't even put it into words. You don't even if it doesn't come back to you, you know that you made a definitive mark in the planet and all that kind of jazz. So, you know, Carl, I kind of want to switch it up a little bit. Still talking about communication, but I want to kind of change our gears now specifically to MBTIs and just your experience with them. And if you don't mind just giving a little introduction for individuals who don't know what it is.
So MBTI is the Myers-Briggs typology indicator, right? So it was created by a mother-daughter team, right? Catherine Briggs and Isabel Briggs Myers. They followed the work of Carl Jung. They developed Myers-Briggs in the mid-30s. They were studying it. They marketed it to different organizations. The military used it to place soldiers and troops into units during World War II. The government also used it to place women into those typical male roles like shipbuilding, bomb building. Maybe you've heard of the Rosie the Riveter. Have you ever seen the poster with the woman with the bandana going like this?
Yeah.
So women played a huge role in shipbuilding, ammunitions building, truck building during the war effort, while, you know, how many men were overseas in Europe. So when the war was over, they came back and went out in the private sector. And so Myers-Briggs has been used. I read a stat the other day of the Forbes 100 or the Fortune 100, 89 organizations out of the Fortune 100 use Myers-Briggs in some sort.
Interesting.
And it's not the first of the personality indexes. You know, Jung fostered a lot of, you know, the personality theory industry that you see today, you know, with Myers-Briggs and and True Colors and temperament theory. And, you know, what was my Disney character? There's some, you know, Match.com and eHarmony used algorithms that are similar from Myers-Briggs and whatnot. But the oldest is the DISC, which maybe you've heard of the DISC profile.
I haven't, no.
Yeah. So it's a personality profile, but it's a workplace behavior profile. And that was actually created by a guy named William Marston, who was the developer of Wonder Woman. So, you know,
wow.
But so Myers-Briggs has been used for 85 years. It's about 70-75% accuracy. Last time I checked, they're always updating the assessment. And really it's pretty cool considering that the assessment is your interpretation of word pairs and what's appropriate, right? So to have that type of accuracy is pretty cool. And they're really working on it. They're always evolving. The best thing that I get out of Myers-Briggs is to recognize that other people have different ways of going about their lives and making decisions. Right. Well, I keep going back to common sense. What I just think is something that everyone probably already has done before or probably already known or, you know, some people, not so much. Right. Absolutely. And so, you know, rather than, and before I got certified and I was, whenever I give somebody instruction, you know, I've been a boss and, you know, been manager for 10 years or just even a team leader or whatever, I tell people, this is what I want. If you could bring it back and be great. And it comes back and it's nothing like,
I wanted
it's totally opposite of what I asked for. My first thought, maybe a lot of people's first thoughts, are what's wrong with that person? Or what's wrong with me? What did I do? Did I give them the clear instructions that they need?
Absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely.
Or you know, what's going on? So there was something wrong, right?
Yeah.
It was either that person or me. So what I realized after Myers-Briggs is, you know, it may not necessarily be something wrong. It may be that I didn't connect with them based off of the way that they like to be connected with and communicated with. So it really has allowed me to be more open to different folks. And I, you know, like I said, I've always been kind of a people person, but it wasn't until I got, you know, acquainted and started studying Myers-Briggs more that it really allowed me to have a better understanding and a better feeling about people and how they do what they do and why they do what they do.
That's huge. And just to share a personal anecdote, so I took this little class or course in university. It was called the Passport to Leadership Program. And the second level of it, we were fortunate enough to do an MBTI and like form our groups into whoever fit into which category. And it was very interesting. There was a question asked to draw a map from one Starbucks on campus to the next Starbucks on campus. And one group that I didn't fit into drew like a very linear map, black and white. Our group, oh man, we had landmarks, we had colors, we had like drawings, yeah. Terrible drawings. But you know, it really just opened my brain up to, wow, you know, like so many individuals experience life differently. And the MBTI is, you know, it just crazy because you really aren't able to understand people at that level. You know, I'm sure even if you ask that colleague, when you ask them to do something, they brought something back, they may not even be able to say like why they didn't comprehend it. Sure. But kind of tying that back into the responsibility factor, that was a very important lesson that I think you just shared with us, Carl. You know, it's not what's wrong with him. It's you brought it into like what's wrong with the way I said it. And then you took responsibility onto how can I make it better in the future. And, you know, I think that's a huge point because a lot of people have had bad bosses, quote unquote, and they tell you to do something. You don't do it to their liking, even though you honestly tried your best, and then you feel crushed and that may cause you to quit. And then that person may just be like that. But ultimately, it's all these soft skills. So a lot of people put soft skills down, but honestly, soft skills are what lead people to such high success. And I I honestly think that if an individual masters soft skills, I don't want to say an increase in double in income, but you can definitively get better results at work. You can get better results in your relationships with friends. You can connect at a better level. And really, I don't even know, Carl, like, go ahead.
It opens doors and creates opportunities that you wouldn't have had before. That's as far as I want to take it that way. You know, double your income, great. Yeah. If that's a possibility, if that really is something that, you know, you pay attention to or that you want to focus on,
absolutely,
that's great. There's a lot of us who are naturally compassionate and empathetic with folks that have to remember that at the end of the day, it's still a business.
Mm.
And we can't give away the business, and we have to, you know, make decisions based off of what's best for the organization, even
sure,
if it causes us stress and strain and consternation. I think there's a happy medium there. And I think it's something that people can meet where they can marry their skills, whether they're inherent or not, of process and people.
Mm-hmm.
And when we're able to put those together, I really enjoy folks that have two letters in the middle of their four letters, NT. It's the exact opposite of me, right? But what I like about those folks is that they are very process oriented. They're always looking to build a better mousetrap and to connect things. They like, you know, blueprints and org charts and flow charts. They want to see connections to things. They want to see, you know, where the bottlenecks are, who I need to speak to, who's there. You know, they like that. And it's a graphical representation of what it is you're talking to. And sometimes you don't have to give them too many words. Okay, well, this is what we're here. Do you get that? Oh, yeah, I'm on it. Don't worry about it. All right, I'm gone. And then you have the rest of us, you know, maybe 60, 70% of us who, if you give us instruction, we need linear step by step, 1, 2, 3, A1, A2, B2, right? We need that. And it frustrates the other folks who are like, well, just give it to me and I'll bring you back exactly what you want, right? And so that group of folks, they're ingenious in that way. But one thing that they can do is they can step on toes because they're so focused on improving the situation. They don't realize that in the spirit of improvement, they're being blunt and direct. And there's a whole lot of us who, when we hear something blunt and direct, we get our feelings hurt, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I'm one of them. I like when people have taken time to connect to create that relationship. And then once we have a relationship and I know that you're there not to beat me down, but you're there to help build me up, you can say pretty much anything you want to me, right? But it's important for us to establish a relationship. So when I tell folks, if you're process-based, that's fantastic.
Yeah.
Learning those soft skills, learning those people skills will open you up to being able to be heard better and also to hear better. And like I said, the more information we can share, the better we're going to be at the end of the day.
Hey everyone, Parham back after another amazing episode with another amazing guest. We hope we added value into your life so you could take the tips from this episode and fuel your process forward. If you enjoyed our episode today and think other friends or family members may also appreciate the lessons that our podcast brings, be sure to share us with them. Subscribe and rate our show so we know how we did. And always remember, trust the process.